Joe First, founder and managing principal of Place Projects, and we're sipping Negronis. Great call on the Negroni.
Great call.
Thank you. It's a good afternoon beverage.
It's a great afternoon beverage. I just got back from Zurich in London, and people were drinking Negronis there. I'm like, wow, you know, this is trending now. Joe's drinking it. The Europeans are drinking it. This sounds like a great afternoon Thursday cocktail.
Perfect. Right on cue.
Cool. Joe, welcome. Welcome. Thank you for joining us. We're excited to talk to you about gentrification. You are the king of gentrification.
It's actually, I would consider it gentrification.
Gentrification. I like that. It's often a dirty word, but there's a lot of great things that have happened because of this so-called gentrification or the changing of neighborhoods. And you were sort of pioneering this move with Tony Goldman in Wynwood in the late 2010-ish, a little bit earlier than that, right?
Well, yeah, my Wynwood story starts in 2008. Through 2018.
Yeah. So, but before we get into that, you know, we kind of want to, you know, you're a Miami boy?
I am, born and raised.
Born and raised. What part of Miami?
South Miami, Coral Gables area.
South Miami, Coral Gables. You went to Ransom?
I went to Ransom.
Yeah. All right. And you play any sports in high school?
I played football, lacrosse, track, played football in college for a little bit.
You went to Hamilton?
Not impressive football, but
you actually played at Hamilton?
I did, yes.
Wow. You ever hit the Turning Stone Casino up there?
Of course. That was the big
Central
activity
New York,
up there.
Baby.
That was it. That's what we did.
I went to Syracuse.
Okay, perfect.
So I spent many a night driving from Syracuse to the Turning Stone Casino. A lot of good memories at Turning Stone.
There was actually so little in Clinton, New York, where Hamilton was, that I used to drive to, funny enough, Hamilton, New York, where Colgate was, to get a slice of pizza. That was the route.
That was the big city.
Yeah.
All right. That's funny. So you played a little, you played lacrosse, football in high school.
Some track too.
So you're kind of an athletic guy then.
I was,
maybe. Are you still athletic? Yeah.
Right now I just try to keep my body in a position to have vitality and wellness. And that means not playing a host of sports and just kind of keeping it pretty basic, stretching, mobility, trying to stay young.
Good. What do you do to work out and stay fit?
I don't know if you want to do this. This is what I really focus most of my time on. So this is a rabbit hole of a conversation, but I do just a lot of mobility work, a lot of stretching work.
What do you mean mobility? What are you doing? Like,
Basic movements with some light resistance.
Yeah.
A lot of just general movement of, you know, keeping flexibility in various joints and muscles and things of that nature to just kind of try to feel well.
Good.
Calisthenics. Keep good posture, all those things. Yes.
You do any running, swimming?
Running, no. Swim a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
play some tennis, play golf. I mean, do the basic sports, but not anything competitive anymore.
But fitness is still a pretty integral part of who you are.
Yeah. I think to have mental wellness, you need physical wellness as well.
This is the guy with a Negroni in his hand right now, right? Hey, it's all about balance.
On special occasions, but
it's all about
this
balance.
Is one of them.
So what's your morning routine usually? Like, you get up in the morning, you work out, or are you an evening guy? What's your morning routine?
Yeah, so, well, I have a beautiful wife and two wonderful kids. And so I try to get up about 45 minutes before any of them. And then I kind of go to my space, which is, I guess, part meditative and other part in this kind of mobility stretching routine. So I do that for about 40 minutes before my kids get up, and then the day starts.
You got a little meditation action going on in the morning too?
Yeah, just, I think, you know, when you work hard and you're a parent of two young children and, you know, there's a lot of things going on, I think having some time alone is always good to start the day.
Absolutely.
And once the day starts, you're never going to get it.
Yeah.
So you better do it before other people wake up.
What time's wake up for you?
About 6:15.
Okay, cool.
Respectable.
So, yeah, respectable.
Yeah, not like not like super respectable, like, oh, I get up at 4:30 and, you know, run 10 miles, but no, just a little bit.
Well, right. We're not trying to be David Goggins in here.
Yeah,
it's all about balance.
Yeah.
So, you went to Ransom.
Yep.
And then you went to Hamilton, obviously, and then you got sick of the Central New York winters and you came back to Miami. And I was reading an interview where your parents are like, oh, I'm going to go figure it out. And they're like, no, you're not. You're going to fucking do this.
Yeah, it's pretty lame. It's actually, it's really embarrassing as an adult to talk about it, but I'm pretty open about talking about things that are embarrassing. But yeah, the story is exactly that. I was, I think, like many other sort of people in college, drifting and without a real clear direction.
What did you major in?
Political science, whatever that is.
International relations, yeah, right here, baby.
Exactly. Whatever that
means. I know what you're talking about.
I was a photography major, so.
but I minored in economics. That was like the ploy to like, hey, like I know something. Yeah. But of course, I knew nothing.
Numbers.
And so I was kind of drifting at that point. And my father, who's a physician and I think very much focused on, you know, ensuring that I had a trade or some sort of licensing to do something, was adamant that I went to law school basically because that was the only additional schooling that I could probably work myself to get into, right?
And miraculously, you got yourself into UM somehow.
Yes, I did.
So you did all right in college.
Yeah, I did fine. Yeah. I mean, I wasn't a complete loser, yeah. But I just wasn't as focused. I wasn't as committed. I was just, you know, I was always a good kid, never got into trouble, but wasn't a focused academic.
Were you dicking around in college? Did you have a job there, or were you just like cruising through college?
Just kind of cruising through, yeah. Did like little odds and ends, but nothing substantive. And then obviously the sports. So,
okay. So then you went to law school and you became a lawyer?
I did. Yeah, no, I passed the bar.
Wow.
I could see. Yeah.
Holy shit. Look at that.
I'm not a deadbeat, guys. No, I passed the bar, and then, I practiced for a couple of years and was really miserable doing it.
Isn't every lawyer miserable? I feel like that's 90% of lawyers are like, I'm trying to get out of here.
I think it's a tough job. I mean, look, if you break apart the two main aspects of the law, which would be litigation or, you know, some form of contractual work, one, the contractual side requires you to do an awful lot of reading where every single word or comma or period has some meaning that could actually have real liability exposed to it. Then on the litigation side, which I think is the more exciting side, where you see people that enjoy it more because it's more of a competition. You know, you many times are taking contingency fees, so you're effectively entrepreneurial in it. That's what I was doing when I practiced law. But the downside to that for me was that I found myself to be a very poor advocate if I didn't really believe in the client's claims or in their goals and things like that. I found it very hard to put up a facade or basically create theater around something that I didn't really believe in. And I think that's where my issue sort of lied as it related to being like a successful litigator and why I was really interested in finding something else to do that I was passionate about.
So how did this passion for real estate come about? I mean, for our listeners that don't know who Goldman Properties is, because that's where you really started your career,
yeah,
right?
Of course.
Like Goldman really kind of began investing in real estate in New York. He's a New Yorker. In what neighborhood was it in New York again?
Well, the first project of great scale and prominence is Soho.
Yeah. So he started investing there. And then like all good New Yorkers, they come down to Miami. And in the late 80s, 90s, right? He started buying assets on South Beach.
Correct.
And then really was kind of integral in helping the historic preservation movement on South Beach. You're clearly a Miami boy. You probably have a Salt Life sticker on the back of your pickup truck too. Or is it a Flow-Grown sticker? Which one is it?
No. The Flow-Grown would probably be better, but no, I don't have either.
So you're kind of probably hear of Goldman Properties and what he's doing on South Beach while you're growing up here between your time in high school and in college. What makes you like, how do you realize, oh shit, like real estate's really interesting to me? Like when did that light bulb like really pop in your head?
Yeah, I think it's actually, there's a couple phases to it. And I think it is worth diving into. So when I was practicing law, my office was at the 54th floor of what was then the Wachovia building, which is 200 Biscayne, which is the tallest building in Miami. So we were one floor below the top.
I worked in that building too. I think we worked there around the same time.
Oh, really?
Too. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, at that time, we're talking 2004 to 2006.
Yep.
And there were cranes everywhere, right? It was that kind of, not the first, but a big construction boom. And I always thought that was interesting. I never really understood how or why any of that came to be. So I was interested in it. And I hated what I was doing. So I also, at least I told myself, which turned out to be true, that I would be much more engaged in something that was tangible in a physical environment of building. I thought that would be interesting, kind of having an influence over a built environment. not too dissimilar from the podcast. And so I felt I need to go to business school. So I went to business school. My wife was also in law school at the same place that I went to business school, who was not my wife at the time. So I was smitten by a girl and I thought it'd be nice to kind of end
up. So you were chasing the hot girls. What was happening?
Yeah.
Under the guise of real estate.
Yeah. So, and I was actually at, even before meeting her, I was looking at other programs, but ended up going to the same school where she was, University of Florida.
And that was an MBA or was it a real estate program?
It was a master's of real estate finance program. Okay. So similar to what they have here at University of Miami.
So at that point you already were like, okay, I'm checking out these cool buildings. I sort of like real estate. Let me go find out a little bit more about what's happening.
And I thought that I needed more of a financial skill set to have a chance of finding an opportunity in the real estate business. So I went to the school. I finished in 07. The world had started to fall apart. And I was doing everything I could at that point. I was very motivated to find an opportunity. And by really just a stroke of good luck, I ended up taking a tour of the Goldman Properties portfolio in South Beach. And it was
What kind of tour was this? Who was doing this?
There was a gentleman that I knew that was interested in historic preservation and how it influenced the economic development. And he had come to town and he had a meeting set up with a gentleman at Goldman Properties named Marlo Courtney, who I love very much.
I've met Marlo. What a great guy.
Great guy. And so he invited me to join the tour. So I joined the tour and it was kind of one of those like immediate moments, like when you know, sort of a love at first sight thing. And it was the first time I'd seen a business that to me was really kind of romantic. It was, you know, had a hospitality angle to it. It had a development angle to it. It had a government relations. It had clearly a shaping community angle to it. And I thought it was fascinating. So then became sort of a long drawn out story, which I'm happy to tell, but I'll pause if you want me to tell it, of sort of trying to get my foot in the door at Goldman Properties, because it was the first thing that I saw that really kind of lit my mind up intellectually to focus on.
We want to hear it all. Tell us how it happened.
Yeah. So I took the tour and Marlo was amazing. And had a subsequent meeting with him. And I realized, you know, very quickly that at that time, you know, there was a great team, but this was the Tony Goldman show. This was a company that was run by Tony and, you know, all kind of major decisions ran through Tony.
And Marlon was kind of the second man in charge, right?
Correct. They had been together for many, many years. But, you know, if you wanted an opportunity there, that had to come from Tony. That wasn't coming from anybody else. And so getting a meeting with him was near impossible. I wasn't sure why at the time, but basically what I did is I penned a letter, I think primarily like on a weekly basis for probably 3 or 4 months.
And this is a handwritten letter.
I was going to say email or paper?
No, paper. This is
beautiful.
Like, yeah.
There's wax seal and everything? Or?
No, but just basic paper. So my father has a series of rules. One of them is paper is cheap, which is obviously the benefit of sending something handwritten. But anyway, and then I ended up having a meeting. They asked me to meet with his daughter, which I did, meeting with his son, which I did, and was sort of always expecting like this next thing. Obviously, finally had a meeting with Tony, and my meeting with Tony was amazing. He's like, look, you're clearly persistent. I'll give you the, you know, you'll come here, you'll work, you know, I'll give you the A to Z, everything I do, you'll do. And I was offering to work for free. I was just trying to, you know, create an opportunity. And so I was like, I left and I was like, this is great. Like, I'm hired, you know, just kind of waiting for the next step. And then that next step never came. So I waited then weeks or a month or however long it took. And then
were you following up with him?
I told Marlo this not too long ago. It's so stalkerish, but I remember one day even driving around like their office on Miami Beach, like trying to see if I could see them. And I saw Tony like having a drink with Marlo or something. And I was like, I didn't quite have the balls to get up and like go interrupt it, but I was just trying to making sure what was going on.
That's amazing.
Randomly, I get an offer letter in the mail. This is a weird story. Yeah, it's a true story. And of course I accept it and I start work July 7th of 2008.
How much were they offering you?
I started, I was offering to work for free. So, but what they ended up paying me was $60,000.
Okay. It's respectable.
Better than free.
Yeah.
A hell of a lot better than free. And they gave me a desk.
They were like,
and I was offering to work on the floor.
This persistent guy deserves a salary.
Right.
But so, I think it's very commendable. Yeah. I think kids these days are not willing to do that. And yeah. I think that's a very important thing to be able to willing to put in the work for free, get the experience. It's not all about the cash.
Don't get me talking about kids these days, because a whole nother issue. But yeah, no, I agree. There's obviously a lot of entitlement, or the idea of deserving things just because you were born. I don't really subscribe to that theory of life. But anyway, I started July 7th of 2008. And literally the next day, Marlo comes over to my desk and he's like, hey, just want to let you know, I'm sure everything's going to be fine, but Tony's going in for a double lung transplant next week.
Holy shit.
And I was like, holy shit. Like, I hope he's okay. Right. There's a lot of factors there. You have the human element, which is like, I hope he's okay. And then you have the work element, which is, it was very clear that this guy, Tony, was a true visionary. And the opportunity that I was also trying to create was to work for him, was to learn from him. And so I also had a professional, like, oh shit, like, is what's going to happen here? You know, it's
sort there's of a transfer of knowledge that has to happen here.
100%.
This is my trajectory, and the guy that's going to transfer that knowledge may not be with the company.
Right. So that's
double
obviously
lung.
A selfish view.
Yeah.
But it was all, we're just being honest. Yeah. Right? So it was like all those factors together. And in Tony Goldman fashion, he had a miraculous surgery, a miraculous recovery.
Was he a smoker or just like,
no,
it was the New York air?
No, it's a disease called interstitial pulmonary fibrosis, which is basically the fibers of your lungs, the amount of oxygen that they absorb starts dwindling. And so obviously your lung capacity starts dwindling. And he had a miraculous recovery. And, wow. You know, for my good fortune, we spent the next 4 years together. It was really where kind of I learned, I wouldn't say the real estate business as a whole, but I learned the idea of really, Tony had an expression that was called, you know, vision is daydreaming with your feet on the ground, which to me was a lot of what I learned from Tony. It was just an idea of always trying to, as he would say, like kind of twist the Rubik's Cube to try to create more opportunities, better outcomes, and always trying to take a creative lens of, you know, improving something from its current form. And so that's kind of that first phase of Goldman Properties.
I don't want to get too sidetracked. Yeah. Sorry to interrupt you. But where did Tony get that from? Because I think that's not normal in real estate developers to be able to be, you know, creative and holistic in the approach. Normally it's like, let's get in, let's get out, let's maximize profits. If sea level rises or it floods, fuck those guys. Like,
yeah,
this is much a totally different. This is a totally different lens. So it's a very unique approach.
Yeah, Tony was a creative. I mean, he was, you know, he actually studied, I think, you know, theater and loved to sing, and you know, he was more of a Renaissance man, we would say. And I think that, you know, he opted to use I think buildings and neighborhoods
was
and places
Jane,
as
Jane
his
Jacobs fan.
I mean, we've all spent
street
obviously
is
yeah
theater, right?
No, like, of course. And I think that was also, you know, instilling, you know, his own operating businesses into real estate. And a lot of the things that, you know, we do as a firm now are obviously, you know, the direct, we'll call it descendants of, you know, of our, at least my learnings, you know, working with Tony.
It's just amazing because normally the creative types don't have the mind to deal with the finance, the structuring, all the other bullshit that comes along with putting real estate deals together. It's that very unique combination of skill sets.
It used to be a lot easier too.
Like,
it used to be a lot easier, right? I mean, real estate wasn't an asset class that was institutional. There weren't as many players in the space. It was much more of a mom and pop business. Like, you know, you raise some money from some friends and you buy a building and you kind of just like work it. I mean, that was
a little more organic,
more the way that it was done.
The barriers of entry were much lower.
Much, much, much lower. It's a completely different business now. And obviously cost, and because it's a much different business, you know, are much higher. So it definitely precludes a little bit more of that mom and pop kind of entrepreneurship model. I mean, there's some guys in town that have done that beautifully well and, you know, made a fortune doing it, but it is harder now than it used to be.
Hey guys, Ben here, taking a quick break from the episode to let you know what Felipe and I have been up to at Gridline Properties. We've been pounding the streets, looking for deals, talking to buyers and sellers. The market is hot and it's extremely active. Despite all the macro uncertainty, the demand for South Florida real estate is at an all-time high. So if you're looking to buy a deal, looking to sell a deal, or you just want some insights into what's going on, hit us up. We have a lot of off-market opportunities stacking and listings coming up. You can give us a call on the main line here at the office, 305-507-7098, or shoot an email to info@gridlineproperties.com, ask for Felipe or Ben, and they'll get you to us. Back to the show.
That's so interesting. So how do you make a place?
Well, there's many factors to that, but I think, you know, in the themes that we're talking about now and going to your commentary about the street, you know, the Jane Jacobs theory on the street, to me, I look at our work as being in two buckets. It's the hardware and it's the software. And in order to have a compelling place, you need compelling elements of both. So the hardware side is obviously, you know, what are the streets like? What are the buildings like? You know, what do they look like? What's the feel? Is it in the human scale? Does it have walkability? You know, all these things that are just kind of brick and mortar rooted to the ground. And then there's the software side of the business, which is the content creation side of the business, right? So, you know, whether it's opening your own food and beverage establishments or going back to like, you know, Goldman Properties days, you know, the Wynwood Walls, or, you know, doing things that create a certain experience, you know, human experience that makes something unique and create these defined moments and create a defined sense of place. Those are the ways that you do it in terms of, you know, creating a place. And so to me, the most fun piece of my work now is that I work in a lot of different environments and I work in different, you know, types of products and really trying to cater to different customers throughout my projects throughout the state. And it's really trying to find, you know, what is actually rooted in, you know, in the history of a place, what's rooted in the community of a place, what things are important to, you know, that subset of people, and then trying to create things that really fit as opposed to trying to import, you know, the same ideas or the same, you know, the same businesses or the same content, you know, everywhere that you go. And it's actually the reason why I named my company what I did, which is Place Projects, which is really about creating projects of place and being unique to place, you know, and not having a name, going back to the conversation before, you know, capital or development or like these things that are make it feel transactional. What I really want to focus on is for profit. I don't want to be mistaken, but for profit community development.
And how do you make that leap? So you're at Goldman for a number of years.
10.
Crash course, 10 years, crash course.
It's a long time at this age, right?
Let me say it's something. It's a long time. It's really incredible. Like, I mean, it must have been kind of like eye-opening for you when Tony had this double lung transplant. Like, you must have been like, holy shit, like, my time is probably very limited with this guy. Like, I need to absorb as much as I can to learn and just like download everything I can from this guy.
And not only this guy, but also this place and this framework and this opportunity, because remember, the Wynwood thing was an idea. So Goldman, let me be specific with the we's, Goldman had acquired, you know, I don't know, maybe let's say 60% of the portfolio that Goldman now currently owns, or that I, you know, then obviously, you know, worked with. And there was really no clear sort of leader to how that was all going to come together. It was very early days in trying to piece together neighborhood associations, or, you know, the ideas of a business improvement district or zoning. Like, all those things were not even like on the table. It was more like, we have all of this real estate in a neighborhood where, you know, there's not a whole lot going on. How do we create, you know, catalytic opportunities to try to make this into something?
And Tony passed away what year?
2012.
And so 2012, it's pretty early days of Wynwood. And yeah. So like,
very early.
I
actually have some personal like sadness on this topic. Sorry to interrupt, yeah. But like, just to frame it from a time perspective, like, Tony never got to see the Wynwood building complete. So for those that are listening that don't know what that is, that's the black and white striped building that became an iconic building in the middle of the neighborhood. The business improvement district, you know, which I created and chaired from its inception till my term was up, that idea wasn't even really in the mix. All the idea of the zoning, like all these, you know, he didn't get to sort of see or participate in any of those things that happened post 2012, which, for people that look at the Wynwood today, which has a series of pros and cons, which we can talk about, and at least offer my perspective. all the, forget the cons for a moment, because let's talk about it more as a dreamer, more in the sense of beauty. But like, you know, he didn't get to see any of those pros that came out of the neighborhood. So that's, you know, kind of an unfortunate reality for me.
But so the baton was basically passed to you, you know, and you had to like figure it out. And it seems like you did, and you were kind of spearheading a lot of the changes that happened with the bid, with the rezoning. Like, I mean, you must have absorbed so much from him in those 4 years to be able to then just like go with it, right?
Yeah, it's in. Let's just kind of tell the rest of the story. So, in 2011, we, you know, and the Goldmans are wonderful people, and obviously have many other assets and other things. But financially, in Wynwood, our portfolio was not good. It was quite challenging. And Tony was really one to not.
And why was it not good? Just not income producing, not valuable.
Definitely not income producing. Very much income losing. So it was, you know, the carry was a huge burden. It was not, you know, it was not a rosy time financially.
How much were you guys losing a year?
Oh, millions. So it's another fun thing about like neighborhood revitalization work that we can talk about. But I will actually just give a quick note to it now. We didn't have our first month of true positive cash flow in that portfolio. I think it was February of 2014, and the first property was bought there in 2005.
Wow.
So just, and there's a lot of things about how is it capitalized, like structure.
The Amazon of real estate here.
Exactly.
There's a lot to unpack as to why that was, and things could have been differently, whatever, but that's just the reality of it. But anyway, 2011, we were, you know, struggling, again, not struggling where people were really struggling, but the portfolio needed to sort of take a different path. And I pitched Tony to allow me to go out and raise outside capital. He really was not typically too keen on having outside partners. It really ran more as a family business. Kind of hit the pavement, ended up raising money and recapping our portfolio.
And how did you raise this capital? Like, where,
talking to people.
Just talking to people.
And I was looking for, you know, I was looking for gentle men or women. You're looking for somebody that you're going to marry. This is not an institutional thing at that time at all. So you're looking for, you know, well-capitalized individuals that, you know, have equal parts the desire to be a good partner. Sure, they want to make money, but they actually care about the spirit of like what you're trying to accomplish. So it's not like just, you know, calling a broker and being like, hey, I need to raise some money.
And are these co-GP partners or LPs?
No,
or
LPs. So yeah, so kind of fast forward, but we closed that recapitalization in May of 2012.
How much did you guys raise?
What was the number at the time? It was probably like 15 million bucks. Like not a ton of money. In the grand scheme of like Wynwood real estate today. Yeah. And then Tony passed away in September of 2012. So what was the kind of the next phase? I look at my experience there in three tranches. The second tranche was, you know, Tony had met our partners a handful of times, but they, you know, they were my relationships, not from before, but relationships that I had built. And so our first partnership meeting was actually after Tony had passed. And so we all felt this great, you know, we all, meaning my, me, you know, Jessica, you know, the us other people that worked within the company felt a great sort of responsibility to make sure that we saw all the things through. And I wrote this long kind of manifesto that basically was like, you know, we were listening kind of all the principles of what we were going to do and sent it to our partners. And that next phase, yes, there was a lot of, autonomy and trust and kind of because of the fact that I'd worked with these people now in putting this together for many, many, many months. And so that next phase was really interesting and obviously quite formative for me as a professional, now having partners and, you know, really being responsible for running this portfolio. And by the way, most people in the neighborhood thought that we were fucked because Tony had died and we didn't, they perceived that we weren't going to do anything.
And how old were you at this point?
I guess this is 2012. So I was 32.
Yeah. You're young. A lot of responsibility.
Yeah. And we used to do a project a year in Wynwood. And then we, you know, in that next year, we did six or seven projects because we were like now properly capitalized and created the whole creative office movement, you know, for the neighborhood. And then obviously went through everything with this rezoning and kind of the rest is history, at least as it relates to those topics.
And looking back now, you think, Wynwood, for people that haven't been down there, like it's fucking incredible what's happening there.
Unrecognizable.
It's unrecognizable. I mean, I remember going there you know, like mid-2000s for those art walks.
You were early days. I mean, when we used to kind of cross paths, it was always like a little bit in that cool kid kind of like Wynwood phase.
Yeah, you know, and
back when it was still stabby.
Yeah, it was very stabby. Like Joey's, they were like going in there and shooting people.
I never, let's be clear. Somebody one time came into Joey's and demanded that they turn over some wallets, but it was not those shootings.
It was a soft stealing.
It was a soft
robbery. But now there's a new development every half block.
Yeah, I mean, like, I hadn't been down to Wynwood, you know, throughout the pandemic, and I started coming down to Gridline. And I mean, I was just, there's like dozens of buildings going up. Would Tony have liked what he's seeing, like what's going on right now?
It's a great question. One that I obviously want to answer with great care and respect. I think what I can do is I will answer that question through my lens, which I think probably has some Tony elements to it. I think that, you know, the idea was always to develop that neighborhood to the scale of Soho, which, you know, the tallest building in Soho is actually a building that Goldman Properties owned, called the Soho building, which I believe from recollection was 12 stories. So I think the scale he would probably find to be appropriate. I think the things that he would be disappointed in, or the things that I'm disappointed in, is the lack of cohesion, you know, and the fact that as the neighborhood and as Miami has grown so quickly, and, you know, you have so many different players there with so many different ideas. And, you know, we created some, what we thought would be governors on development through the rezoning with the Wynwood Design Review Committee and trying to do some thoughtful things related to, you know, arts programming for the buildings and signage regulations. And we tried to do a bunch of different levers. But I think at the end of the day, he would be a little disappointed with the attention that's been paid to some of the development patterns, some of the development projects. And then I think to the, maybe the lack of consistency in the offerings, the content side of the business within the district. Things that I really used to celebrate.
When you mean content, what do you mean by that?
Just like when I would be asked about, you know, Wynwood and, you know, what it's all going to be, part of the beauty of the neighborhood was that it was not contrived. It was not singularly controlled. It's the opposite of, you know, Disney World, right? You have a lot of different people that could do a lot of different things. And the thought was that if you could put in some guardrails to kind of, you know, allow flexibility, but still have some guardrails to those outcomes, that you would probably have a great end result that would be truly authentic and have a lot of integrity to it. And I think that, you know, maybe where that disappointment would lie is the fact that some of the things that have happened have been really quite maybe outside of the guardrails in terms of some of the scale of some of the projects, you know, and then again, some of the content, some of the uses that are there. I think there's probably could be some more cohesion to that.
Any specific examples you want to share?
I don't really have any exact examples to share.
There's no Starbucks there yet, so that's good.
It's coming.
You really?
Oh yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, that's then there's a specific example. Right,
yeah, but
there.
I mean, there aren't really that many chains there yet.
There aren't that many chains there yet because the retail environment, retail is a tricky thing, right? Like for when you think about chains, they come in food and beverage variety, and they come in obviously like just general, you know, dry goods, commercial. And the environment there is not cohesive enough for it to be a true shopping district. So you've not really seen that many big, you know, retail brands that feel the need to be there because it's sort of like, where do I go? This block's not developed. Like the walkability is a little bit weird, things like that. But you do see some in food and beverage, and you'll see more.
That's disappointing. Like last thing I would want to see in Wynwood is Starbucks. Like,
you know, I don't.
Why isn't Vice City Bean on every corner instead? You know,
look,
maybe pricing, you know, I don't.
I'm glad we're having a drink. This conversation can go really deep real quick, but I don't know if it is as disappointing as maybe I would have thought it would have been. And I say that for this sole reason. Going to your opening line about gentrification, which I have learned in obviously the work that I do, and not just here in Miami, but in other places, definitely has many different meanings to many different people. But I think the core idea of gentrification is obviously, or the negative idea is the displacement of, you know, hopefully just, you know, commercial enterprise, not so much on the residential perspective, but the displacement of things for the installation of new things, right? I mean, that's basically what it is. But the outcome of that really is that if you think that Wynwood should have been all of these, you know, kind of just hipster creative class users, and it should have been like that frozen in time, then neighborhoods like Little River or Alapata or even where we're sitting now wouldn't necessarily have been had the opportunity to start having these turns. So when I think people, what people get confused about is that thinking that real estate and that place and neighborhoods are static and that they just should remain the same through time. If that were the case, general growth in urban areas like i.e. Miami would never occur because there wouldn't be a need to find new things or, you know, new creative grounds to create new opportunities. And then neighborhoods would sort of all not necessarily have as much of a unique character as they end up having because of these sort of ebbs and flows of gentrification. So that's a whole different topic, but I think that Wynwood going to be what it was conceived to be back in 2010 when I used to think about it? Absolutely not. Is it going to feel more like a lower rise Brickell in terms of density, intensity, and whatever? Yes. Is that really bad? Not really. No. It gives other opportunities for other places in town.
It's about embracing change and riding the wave. Like, it was that vision at one point in time, and now it's moved past that.
I mean, cities are constantly evolving, right? Like you just said. So, you know, Wynwood had its glory days a long time ago. Then it went into decline. It's having another glory day. It's probably going to have some sort of decline 50, 100 years from now. Who knows? But that's just the reality of cities. Like, they're ebbs and flows.
There are. And I think now we're wearing, you know, different hats. We're talking as consumers. We're talking as, you know, residents, as people who care about where they live. Wearing a more of a private sector hat as a, you know, as a quote unquote developer, which I really don't refer to myself as, but then there'd be much more disappointment because you're not really being able to control or curate what the experience is the way that others who develop, you know, larger scale mixed use products are. For my, what I do in West Palm Beach is Project Nora. I'm not skipping ahead. I don't know exactly where all the questions are
going to go. We're going to get there.
But I will say that is an opportunity to do, to me, to have a fully controlled, curated urban experience. So that is kind of taking a lot of lessons learned from Wynwood and bringing it into something that is actually master planned and controlled. So I think that's going to have I'm very interested to see that outcome once, now that those, you know, that those really, those controls or restraints are in place. It should be interesting.
Just going back to, you know, circling back and going full circle with like Soho. Like Soho, you know, was very gritty. Today, it's like, it's all chains there too, right? Like it's very, I mean, you have really high-end brands there, you know, like Tony probably today would have been probably not so happy about that.
I don't know. So it's interesting. And I feel very comfortable sharing this. I don't think anyone would be upset, but I actually remember when Tony signed the first luxury retailer lease that they had in their portfolio in Soho was Christian Dior, I believe. And I remember him signing that lease and having a moment of actually great pride, you know, that something that had come so far, yeah, right, from like these polar opposites, these extremes, and that, you know, that sort of had ended up at like what would be, no, maybe not everybody thinks it's like, you know, the top of the food chain, but at least from, when you think about rent, when you think about, you know, brand, when you think about luxury and trying to kind of get to those levels, I mean, you know, it all sort of happened in the end.
It makes sense. It's like skaters, like, you know, fuck you, that's not core skating, like, you know, it's poser shit,
right?
But like, you got to embrace you got to let the big brands eat, and you got to embrace the progression if that this is your industry.
Exactly. And again, like, I tried to make it very clear about, you know, my sort of my business and our thesis, but like, we are a for-profit business, and anybody that thinks that, you know, we're not also focused on ensuring that we're having good financial outcomes is misplaced. I mean, I don't think that those two things can exist together. I think that they can exist together quite fine. So
absolutely. So how do you take the learnings from here and do something like was it Palm Beach you said?
Yeah, for Nora.
Yeah, for Nora. Do you really take a macro view of it? You kind of like what brings you into a place like that?
Yeah,
like what draws your attention?
Yeah, so I mean, what is you, so you had almost a 10-year run with Goldman. And then which was pretty glorious, I think. You left in 2018?
18.
Yeah. And then you're like, all right, let me see where else I'm going to go gentrify. And, what was the word that you used?
It's a Tony term. It's gentrification.
Gentrification.
We can use revitalize the more.
All right. I'm just fucking with you, Joe.
It's okay.
Where are we going to revitalize next? And you decided to start your own firm in 2018. You did a project in Doral. And then you start kind of looking at the next, you know, what's the next neighborhood that has the bones that were similar to Wynwood, that have the right streets, the right, you know, types of buildings where you can kind of convert them and where there are warehouses, retail, where there's walkability. And at what point do you settle on this area in West Palm Beach?
Yeah, so I think just comparing to one of your other guests, like Arnaud, who's much more methodical and focused as to kind of building to next steps, I take a more passive role in that and sort of believe that if you do good work and if you kind of are a good person, the world might kind of reward you in time. So when I left Goldman, I had already started a few other initiatives, a real estate portfolio out in Doral, with some elements of the Goldman family, obviously the Doral Yard that, you know, with Della, and then a portfolio on the west coast of Florida in St. Petersburg. And it was just sort of my time to go out on my own. I thought my work was sort of complete in Wynwood, and thought it would be maybe more interesting to try kind of that next phase, like, you know, without having, you know, with just having my own business and be able to make my own rules around it.
Was that a big financial leap for you? Or did you have ownership from the Goldman deal, so you were a little bit more comfortable making that? Like, what was that leap like for you?
It's a great question, and one that we should probably talk about. Yes. So, two things. I think it's always good to be very honest about these items, because sometimes you hear these stories and
no one actually wants to talk about it. Yeah.
Well, it sounds like you have a sugar mama too. That's a high performing attorney too. So, you take the risk.
Well, I think that's twofold. I actually was going to use her. I mean, I think first and foremost, you know, I was part of a dual income household.
Yeah.
So at that time, it wasn't like when I left, you know, that moment that I had zero income. But I think, you know, obviously, more importantly, I was a partner in our Wynwood portfolio, and it was sort of a complex structure, and it was complex in terms of unwinding from that and, you know, eventually getting bought out from it, which was my goal. But
Has Goldman sold any assets in Wynwood?
Goldman has not, to my knowledge that I can think of at the moment, sold any assets in Wynwood. But, they did right by me, and, took some time, but over, you know, 5 or 6 months after I left, I was able to sort of orchestrate the buyout of my interest in Wynwood. And so I, you know, had the ability to go, you know, do things on my own.
Take a little risk.
Exactly. And so without that event, without probably my wife having a consistent income, and without really what I would consider, like, actually I think this is a Tony thing too that he taught me, kind of the Tarzan theory of opportunities, you know, like you always got to have like the next rope to kind of go to before you're, or the next vine to go to before you let go of the other one. You know, with the St. Pete thing, Doral, and 545 Wynn, which was a partnership with Sterling Bay, which is an office building we built in Wynwood, I had all these things going actually while I was still at Goldman Properties. So when I left, it was like, I actually had work. I didn't just like leave and wake up one day and be like, oh shit. Okay. Like, now what do I do? So anyway, that's kind of how that happened. And then about 6 months after I left, I got a call from, this group in West Palm Beach who had acquired a couple of buildings in this area that we now call Nora. And
where is it exactly in West Palm?
It's really great. It's east of the tracks. So our boundaries would be, the west boundary would be the east side of the tracks. Our southern boundary would be Quadril, which is kind of a main road that turns into the North Bridge to go to Palm Beach Island. The north boundary would be Palm Beach Lakes Boulevard, which is a direct exit off of I-95, and our eastern boundary would be Dixie. And it got a call anyway from a guy from this group that had acquired a couple of buildings and thought that there might be something bigger to do there that didn't have subject matter expertise in neighborhood rezoning work and the curation of tenants, of the visioning of neighborhoods, of how to capitalize a project like this, how to get it off the ground, you know, all the things that obviously I had done in my previous life at Goldman. And we hit it off, and there's a lot more to unpack there, but sort of the rest is history. And what we ended up with is we now own about 14 acres. We've gone through a full master plan and re-entitlement process with the city of West Palm Beach.
Who's we?
This is me and my partners. So my partners, this partnership is my firm. The other local West Palm partner that I was referencing before is called NDT Development. And then we have an institutional capital partner, which is Wheelock Street Capital.
And are all these relationships you made at Goldman or after?
All after.
Interesting. And so what made you think this was going to work?
This is...
Palm Beach is a different animal than Miami.
Different animal. West Palm, to be specific. Because Palm Beach and West Palm are also different animals.
This isn't worth Ave.
This is not worth Ave, no. This is an opportunity that I will never have again in my career. This is a sort of a palette, we'll say, that we have complete control over. We own the main street of the project. It's called North Railroad Avenue, hence the name Nora. It's a 1400 foot linear foot street. We own all of the properties on the east and the west side of the street, and we own 10 acres of contiguous land that is slated for vertical development. And so what this is really a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to have incredible character and incredible fabric of a primarily adaptive reuse main street. So kind of get the vibes that you would want to get from a place that has been, you know, reinvented as opposed to newly built, but and also to plan and zone it in a way that all of those, the character elements and all of that main street will remain in perpetuity around all this other development that is getting built immediately connected to, but not within that main street. So if you think about the great flaw of the majority of the urban revitalization neighborhoods, they go through the same themes. Space tends to be, there tends to be buildings that are built. They tend to be underutilized. Cool people come in and do cool things. Then it becomes a place that people want to go. Then development pressures come in. The original fabric, original buildings, and those original, we'll call them, you know, pillars of those communities get displaced, buildings get raised, and then new things get built in their place. And then you sort of are going through the same conversation about Wynwood. You know, is it what it was? Is it, you know, what there's all this transition?
And how do you preserve that authenticity?
Exactly. And what we have in Nora, because we own all of it in terms of all of these areas that are getting, you know, the most kind of redevelopment, is we have our main street, which will be there in perpetuity. Those buildings will remain. They're not getting raised and redeveloped. And then we have all of our land assets, which is where all that vertical development will happen. So it's about 2 million square feet of vertical development. So it's kind of, to me, it's the best of both worlds. And it's a project that I'm incredibly proud of and very excited about, and hope that once it's open to the public, which will be next year, that, you know, some of our good Miami folks come up there to check it out.
I mean, it's a badass approach. Sorry, Felipe, because I always wonder why developers don't buy everything around a big
they try. It depends,
right? But you're boosting land values of so much land in the area, like, you might as well control it all. So that's a pretty, it's a dope way to control an entire area and really be able to drive vision for
but so much luck goes into that. I mean, you know, the acquisition,
14 acres is no joke.
I mean, this is 86 different parcels over 34 different transactions. I mean, this is a miracle acquisition story. So there's a lot of pieces to kind of,
and having the right capital behind you to be able to do that. Like, that's throw your nuts on the table.
This is the area just south of the convention center.
No, this is north. This is
north of the convention center.
So on the map, go to Well, I can give you an address if you'd like.
Yeah, please.
Yeah, we're just nerding out over here on Google Maps.
No, I what we consider as our centerpiece of the neighborhood would be 905 North Railroad Avenue, West Palm.
Railroad Avenue?
Yeah.
And what a great history to build off of with the Flagler bringing the railroad down. I mean, that's a really cool history.
These are all old industrial rail buildings. You know, they're built between the 20s and the 30s, a couple later ones. Our first phase of the retail that we're talking about is 160,000 square feet. It's across 13 buildings, 9 of which are adaptive reuse and 4 new construction, but still with matching scale.
That's so cool. It's such a great way to give like a good vibe to a development is meshing the old and the new. We talked to Kobe last week about the surf club and just that amazing mesh of the surf club and then the Richard Meyer, like, you know, condo buildings next door. It's just, I think you're going to kill it in Palm Beach, West Palm.
Thanks. I mean, it's really how you create place. Again, it's going back to those historical elements, right? And if everything just starts with dirt and you build everything new, then it's very hard. I mean, there's beautiful architecture and all
these things. Well, there's no storytelling. You have a very strong storytelling narrative to build off of, which I think is key.
It's great. And I will tell you, this is going to be an interesting execution because that first phase of retail is extraordinarily hospitality centric and food and beverage centric. I think that we will, and I mean this with absolute certainty and confidence, I think that we will be the single best food and beverage destination for sure in the state and arguably in the country in terms of the quality of operators that we'll have in the district. And I think that this will be a destination that people come from legitimately far and wide, you know, to come experience.
I love the confidence show.
Any names you can drop or what?
Yeah.
We have all the big names. It's funny. All the big names will be announced probably in the next 6 weeks.
Oh, fuck. We're 6 weeks too early.
We
got to do this again.
But we have a great lineup that have already been announced. I think we've made 8 or 9, 10 announcements. And
this is all food and beverage and hospitality?
It's not all, but I think it's, when you think about retail districts, this is definitely a heavier, leaning heavier on hospitality.
What other retailers are you recruiting right now?
So our sort of thesis on the kind of leasing strategy has been to focus on our bigger food and beverage users and some fitness users on the front end. And then our dry goods, you know, like our more like kind of boutique one-off retailers will start to go after we make all these big announcements related to food and beverage. Because we have very high quality operators that are going to be, you know, a part of the project. And we obviously think that the retailers are going to be very compelled to be there once they understand all the things that are really coming to fruition.
How do you curate that? Like, that's a lot of eating, a lot of drinking. Like, how do you figure out these guys are good, these guys are good, these guys are good? Do you work with a brokerage? Is it like...
We do our own brokerage.
That's a lot of research and development on...
With all due respect to Gridline Properties, so I love these guys. These are wonderful people. For a project like this, I do not believe in third-party brokerage. I think that you need to have somebody who wakes up every morning and for projects called Nora. So that puts on their Nora hat every day and goes to the office every day telling one story. I don't think you can do it third party. So we have a wonderful head of leasing, that we hired, you know, who kind of, you know, sees a lot of these things through. And then we, you know, between myself and my partners, we have extraordinary relationships with hospitality operators. And I do want to give credit to one person in particular. So when I worked at Goldman Properties, this is a little bit of a fanboy thing, but we're going to do it anyway. When I worked at Goldman Properties and, you know, when Tony was still with us, I would go up to New York, I'd say once a month and, you know, sit with Tony because he would kind of be between Miami and New York. And I would always stay at the Bowery Hotel, which to me was... I didn't know anything really about hotels or hospitality, but I knew that when I stepped into the Bowery Hotel... that I was like home.
The
I was
spot.
Like, this is what it's all about. And I obviously like looked up, I knew who owned it, but I didn't really understand anything around that. And you know, soon after we kicked off Nora, you know, and closed with our capital partner, we had a hotel site that we wanted to kind of kick off like immediately. So when we deliver the retail, we're delivering a hotel like immediately thereafter. And my capital partner reached out to me. He said, hey, he's like, I don't want to step on your toes, you know, with the hotel thing, but would you be interested in having a conversation with Richard Bourne? And I was like, that name might not ring a bell to you guys, but I was like, absolutely. Richard Bourne is the gentleman who's did the Bowery and the Mercer and the Greenwich and the Maritime, the Ludlow, the Jane, now the Chelsea, you know, I mean, all of these great, what feel like independent hotels, you know, in New York City.
He's a beast.
He is a beast. I mean, there's nobody like him. And anyway, he has a place down here. We had a drink on a Friday. He came to visit the portfolio at Nora on a Saturday or a Sunday. And we had a deal done by the end of the following week. And so having Richard as our hotel partner and doing a hotel with Richard Bourne, Beatty Hotels, Sean McPherson, et cetera, is very helpful to get food and beverage folks Absolutely. Excited about being in your neighborhood.
And so what do you think is going to be the drive for locals? Are you guys just going to put graffiti on warehouses again?
Or no, absolutely not. This is
Palm Beach people. They don't want to see graffiti.
Hey, I know, but how many times has Wynwood been tried to replicate? People throw graffiti on a building. You're like, oh, this is just like Wynwood. There's paint over there.
But look, the Wynwood story, you know, I think going back to authenticity and like trying to be specific to, you know, the history of a community. I mean, you know, Primary Flight should get a lot of credit. Going back to Wynwood, I mean, Primary Flight were the guys that started doing the first site-specific murals in Miami that really started to create that sense of place through street art, you know, well before the Wynwood walls. And you had, you know, other graffiti artists doing things before that. You had Purpose Young painting in that neighborhood. I mean, that neighborhood actually used public art and graphics as the expression and I can define the neighborhood. There were two local painters, because you guys remember, that used to paint all the hand-painted signage and, you know, the shoe wholesalers, all the shoes and the shirts. You know, the neighborhood always used art, painted art graphics as its vernacular. It was actually made perfect sense for all that to take place in Wynwood. That's not the case with what we have in West Palm. So West Palm, we're delivering is something that feels, it's a lot more controlled. It's a lot higher design. It's more, you know, sophisticated than that. We're going to have a great public art program as well, but it's definitely not in a graffiti vernacular. It's something that's definitely much more sophisticated.
And authentic to that place.
Sure. Not the buildings. Again, we're keeping all the bones of the adaptive reuse buildings, but they are getting, you know, significantly upgraded in terms of operable storefronts.
But that's where the magic is. And I think it's a lot of times where developers go astray is they try to bring something from another town, like say Wynwood, and they try to build in Little Havana and say, this is just like Wynwood. We put some graffiti on the outside. And it's like, dude.
I think that's weak.
Yeah, it's super weak. So when you do that placemaking in other cities, it's really cool to see you're drawing from the authenticity of that, augmenting it, and then presenting it to the public. Like,
yeah,
it's a really cool thesis.
So a couple questions, Joe. You said you guys acquired 14 acres. How many properties?
I think it's like 85.
How long did it take to acquire those? Over what period of time? And what kind of coin do you guys drop on that?
We started, I started working on this in the beginning of 2019. Right. So, and my partners had a couple buildings that they, you know, had under contract at the time. So it took us, it's actually my partners at NDT get a lot of credit for many things. But one thing was, I think, being naive enough to think that all this stuff could happen so quickly. So like in Wynwood, if you think about Wynwood, it was like, we have bought some properties. We started to do some like re-tenanting. We started to make it cool. We did a little neighborhood association. We then created a bid. We then went through this rezoning. I mean, that whole process took 10 years.
Yeah.
And my partners in West Palm, when we first started, were like, we're just going to do that all at the same time. And I was like, maybe, I don't know. But yeah, so between 2019, we were able to, from 2019 to 2022, March of 2022, we were able to acquire all the properties. We were able to work, you know, hand in hand with the city of West Palm Beach and create an entirely new master plan, go through 15 public hearings to get all of that codified and complete. And then with our new partner recapitalized by, I guess, February or March of 22. So I guess really three years.
Dang, that's quick.
It's actually remarkable. Yeah.
And how were you able to get all those properties bought? Like, were you paying above market prices, or like, what were
No one was interested, right? I mean, a lot of this was pre-COVID. So no, the people weren't really as interested in the market. And then during COVID, there were some just weird things that happened. Certain individuals thought that if Biden got elected, capital gains taxes were to go to 75%. So they need to sell now. There were a couple large swaths that were owned by, you know, certain individuals that, you know, obviously were, they were happy to sell them at the time because, you know, nothing had been happening. Just all kinds of just wild kind of deal stories that I think are of interest. That when all the dust settled, you know, we had it all pieced together. We got all the master planning done. And I think in terms of our initial acquisition phase, I think we got up to about probably about $35 million in our initial acquisition phase. And obviously from there, you know, I hate using the terminology because I think it comes up way too often and it seems completely lame, but if we actually build out the whole project, it'll be a $1 billion project. So it's like, you know, that's kind of just riding the different stories of, you know, what you kind of acquired in the horizontal, you know, to create the place and then the ability to create all the vertical development opportunities that then obviously create, you know, something that's of a grand scale.
Are you guys doing anything vertical at this point?
The hotel. So of the 13, you know, primary retail buildings, we have 4 new construction ones. They're 2 stories. I don't really consider that vertical. The hotel is effectively an 80-foot building. So I do consider that vertical. It's 201 keys.
Is that the eight stories is the max height there?
That is actually a 6-story height, but you can get to 80 something feet based on the way the code works. The 8-story product that we have is to 125 feet. We have a 15-story product and a 20-story product. So
20-story, huh?
The hotel, we're in the market for debt as we speak. It's actually surprisingly been a pretty good process. And we're set to break ground on the hotel probably by the end of the summer. And that'll be complete in the beginning of 2026.
Well, that helps with good partners too.
Great partners.
And how do you convince a capital partner to spend $30 million
I think they spent more, but we're talking about like the initial acquisition.
Yeah,
but,
yeah. No, how do you find someone like
that? Yeah, we have an amazing capital partner, Wheelock Street Capital. I'm going to plug them because they're wonderful.
Please.
But yeah, I think when we were looking for a partner, this kind of gets a little bit like real estate-y, but let's do it. Just coming from Goldman Properties and knowing this type of project, you need a partner who's comfortable and has expertise in all asset classes. You can't call a partner who does like just multifamily development, because then the retail, they're going to be like, I don't get this. Why are we spending money on retail? So finding a capital partner that actually does it all is very challenging. You know, and it's not that easy. And who does it all, who's willing to do it entrepreneurially, is even more challenging. So that's number one. Number two is that, you know, West Palm is a relatively new market for institutional capital, right? I mean, it's Related's doing their thing there, and that's great. But there haven't been that many other players pre-COVID that were like focused on West Palm Beach. So having a capital partner that has, you know, that's along the market or knows the market also, you know, would likely be a challenge. And fortunately, Wheelock Street Capital had both of those things. They have other investments in the market before Nora. They are extraordinarily entrepreneurial in all the spaces that we mentioned. So what we wanted to do, different than the Wynwood story with Goldman Properties, is what we wanted to do as, you know, the developers of what we call the horizontal or doing all the placemake, is we want to make sure that when apartments were built in the neighborhood that we participated in that, when a hotel was built in the neighborhood that we participated in that. In order to do that, you really need a capital partner who wants to do all of those different product types in the same place. And that's what Wheelock basically offers. And they've been an extraordinary partner. And this is a wildly entrepreneurial project. I mean, this is like, you know, starting from zero. So
cowboy shit. Yeah.
It's cowboy shit. I mean, for real estate, it's cowboy shit.
But so, listen, you got Palm Beach to the east of you. Like, there's so much money there. Like, and there's more money coming from the Northeast and Chicago. It's fucking insane. It's, like, yeah, we had Brian Bandel on the show, you know, a few months ago. And there's kind of like this donut hole, right? Like, and we love shitting on Fort Lauderdale on this podcast. Like, it's like,
it's a flyover state, you know? Yeah, when I take my Brightline to Palm Beach, I never stop in Fort Lauderdale. Exactly. I just go right through it.
No one stops in Fort Lauderdale.
Unless you're dying for Applebee's, yeah, right? Yeah.
So you got Miami.
It'll get there.
And then, eventually. And then you have West Palm Beach, which seems like it's just popping right now too, right? So like your timing seems impeccable.
Yeah, we got lucky with the COVID thing for sure.
Yeah. So, Good shit, Joe.
So what's next?
Well, I got a whole other thing on the west coast of Florida in St. Petersburg. That's you know, taken.
Do you know Michael Tillman?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, Michael's doing some stuff over there.
Yeah, he you know, obviously did the hotel there, yeah. And he's got some other projects going. My project there is very similar to, it's what I do. So I'll get a quick snippet, but basically 4.5 years ago, we acquired a whole bunch of land in an area that was actually funny. It was in what was considered the Warehouse Arts District, but all industrial land. And after, you know, talking to community members and other folks, it was very clear that, you know, there was a whole vision laid out for this place. And the vision that they wanted to see was exactly what I thought should be there. So again, like kind of marrying like what people actually want to then an outcome. But they said, oh, it's impossible. There's you're never going to be able to do any of this work. You know, the city, the county, like it's just never going to happen. And so, you know, after doing a lot of research and talking to as many people as I could, we felt comfortable that we could kind of, you know, take the risk to do it. And 4.5 years later, we're actually in the middle of our public hearing process for a complete new framework that I think is, in a way, one of the things that I think I'll be most proud of, because it has certain requirements for arts and artisan spaces on the ground floors of buildings. It's like very creative code. It's something that you would be hard pressed to be able to pull off in the city of Miami. It's really kind of out there stuff, but that I think is going to create really a long lasting sort of community aspect, keep a lot of fabric in place, like talking about the evolution of neighborhoods. And that's kind of the next project once that all completes.
Cool.
So is that the initial is getting the zoning right and getting the fabric laid out, and then you go in and start actually building shit?
Yeah, exactly. So we've got to get that framework in place. And that's been, I mean, legitimately 4.5 years of, and wow. I think I have a tally somewhere, but I think it's been 135 different community, political, you know, you name it, kind of meetings to get.
Why is West Palm fast tracking shit and St. Pete is taking so much longer?
West Palm, the city of West Palm, I mean, I've now done this type of work. When I say this type of work, meaning, you know, real estate work that has a large kind of public sector process to it, because it has a planning and zoning angle to it, in four different municipalities in the state. So I've obviously done it in the city of Miami, Doral, St. Petersburg, and West Palm. West Palm is, I think, brilliant. I think it's incredibly, when I say pro-business, I don't mean that in like a nonsensical, like Republican way. I mean, they actually just, they appreciate that there's an opportunity here now because of kind of trends that have taken place throughout the country, and that they should really be like taking in all the best ideas that they possibly can and trying to implement responsible, you know, development in town. And so they really are great. So yes, I think it's completely crazy. And I tell this a lot to people, that this thing that I'm doing in St. Pete, which has also been wonderful, different. The St. Pete, they really are focused on kind of the Austin motto of like, keep St. Pete weird, keep Austin weird, keep it local, coming from out of town, very wary of out of towners. And it took a long time to build trust and confidence.
Especially Miami people.
Yeah. And it took a long time to build trust and confidence in not in the locals, but in demonstrating to public officials and city staff members that this was a community initiative, not like some guy from Miami, like, you know, so that took, but yes. So West Palm, the first property in West Palm was acquired after the acquisitions in St. Pete. And I mean, we're obviously like light years ahead from a project schedule perspective in West Palm than in St. Pete.
Unbelievable. It's like the city of Miami too. It's a disaster.
Yeah. City of Miami is, you know, the city of Miami thing makes me sad, honestly. It just makes me sad. I mean, you have, you know, all the eyes of the entire world, you know, focused here. You have, you can come up with 50 different incredible stories about things that have taken place here, you know, since COVID, and you still have a local government that can't, you know, come up with the appropriate behaviors, the appropriate sophistication, and the appropriate just kind of will to try to kind of match all of the great things that have happened here. And I think that's really unfortunate.
Are you trying to do anything here now, or are you focused everywhere else?
Yeah, I'm not trying to do anything here, but I do think for the work that I kind of deeply care about and think that I'm best suited for, which is this kind of large scale, you know, macro neighborhood work. I think the opportunities here are more limited. I think that, again, the whole planning and zoning element to it, and, you know, public-private partnership, which is what these things really are, I think it could be a more challenging endeavor to do that here. For the right opportunity, I would love to roll up my sleeves and kind of, you know, believe in the ability to get it done. But again, of course, I've had my hands full, you know, out of town. So
totally. Would you ever go out of state? Or are you Florida focused?
I don't think now. You know, I'm really
flow grown.
It's not that I'm flow grown. It's that I mean, going back to the life elements, man. Like, you know, I have an 8-year-old and an 11-year-old, and we all, you know, work hard and do all these things. But I would really like to avoid being on airplanes and, you know, more nights away from home and all those things. Because I think, obviously, for me, I think most people would say this, that our parents, you know, being present for my children and being engaged as a father is more important than any of the other things that we're talking about. So
I hear that.
Amen.
Yeah. Cool, Joe. I think that's good, right?
I think we nailed it.
I think we're going to have you back here on the podcast in a couple of years after you start killing it in West Palm.
Well, get an update. What we'll do is we can do an offsite.
There we go.
We take the podcast on the road.
I love it.
Let's do it.
We do it at the hotel.
I love
it. And we, you know, and you maybe do some Palm Beach folks. There's definitely some characters in Palm Beach and West Palm Beach to talk to.
Yeah. We'll do it. Let's do it. Done.
Yeah. Cool, thank Joe. You guys for having me.
Yeah, thanks, man. Appreciate that. It was great chatting with you, dude.
Thank you.
All right.
Cheers. Bye.